for 6 case, the United States versus Nunes. Mr. Donovan.
May it please the court and opposing counsel. I'm attorney Chris Donovan. I represent Miguel Nunes on this appeal. This case is about a fundamental due process right to be sentenced upon accurate and reliable information. The specific context in this case is whether or not Mr. Nunes was eligible for the safety valve reduction, but the larger issue that we're asking this court to clarify and provide guidance on is whether what the government presented in this case was enough for the trial court to deny Mr. Nunes's valuable statutory right. Basically, in this case, the government's trying to have its cake and trying to eat it, too. On the one hand, it wants to deny Mr. Nunes safety valve eligibility based solely on an undisclosed, unidentified, and uncorroborated hearsay statement from a CI, a confidential informant. On the other hand, it doesn't want to tell the court or defense counsel anything about the CI to test the reliability and accuracy of the CI's assertions. And in fact, the government at sentencing even went as far to say, frankly, disclosing his identity in this case is not worth it to the government. The pre-sentence report in this case found that Mr. Nunes was safety valve eligible. He found that he satisfied the five factors. He had no criminal, well, he had less than one criminal history point. He used no violence or threats of violence. The offense did not involve death or serious bodily injury. He was not a leader or organizer. And the PSR found that he provided truthful information relating to the offense and all relevant conduct.
Don't I remember that he refused to talk the second time?
The second debrief is not part of this record. This goes to the motion I filed to strike portions of the government's brief. Notes from the second debrief was never turned over to me as defense counsel. It was not produced for the district court to consider. So the only information in this record about what Mr. Nunes talked about in his debrief is from the first debrief. And at that debrief, he provided numerous details about this case and relevant conduct.
At the trial level, at the sentencing, did the government take the position orally before the court that he had refused to respond?
Yes, the government at sentencing did take that position, but again, it wasn't part of the record. It was just an assertion by the government.
It wasn't part of the record insofar as it was a statement of the prosecutor that he had failed or refused to.
Correct. As far as the assertion at sentencing, yes, that is part of the record, but the underlying debrief was not produced, was not turned over, and the court did not have it under.
If he refused to answer, there wouldn't be a debriefing.
I'm sorry?
If he had refused to answer, there wouldn't be a record of debriefing. It's just he refused to participate in the debriefing.
Well, there's no indication that he refused to answer or give full information.
Except the allegation or the statement in court by the prosecutor that he refused.
Correct. Correct.
Did anybody dispute that statement by the prosecutor?
I did not dispute that statement because, again, I wasn't produced underlying debrief. I was aware. I was second counsel on this case. I took over prior to
plea. You weren't aware of what the government said to the court?
No, I was aware that there was a second debrief. I was not aware of what the contents of that debrief was or what did or didn't occur at that debrief.
Well, couldn't you have asked your client?
I did discuss with my client. My client basically informed me that he was fully honest and open about what happened. Again, at the first debrief, he gave numerous backgrounds. He gives background on his...
Well, I'm going back to the second one. Did you ask him whether he refused to answer questions in the second debriefing?
He indicated to me that he did not refuse to answer or didn't
did
address...
Did you call that to the attention of the court?
I did not. So, again, in this case, the PSR found him eligible. This court has a long line of cases and precedent that say that when that the court may rely upon information contained in the PSR as long as it's well-supported and appears reliable. So at that point, I believe it was the government's burden when they came forth asserting that this CI, what the CI said was accurate, meaning that Mr. Nunes lied about certain things or withheld certain things, that it was their burden to prove why that was reliable or accurate. Because that was the first time in the case that there was any indication that he was not going to be safety valve eligible or that he wasn't entitled to that statutory right. Other circuits have held that when a defendant has made a facially plausible showing of safety valve eligibility, that it's the government who must show that such a showing is either untrue or incomplete. I cite to the two other circuits in my reply brief, the Ninth Circuit and the First Circuit. And the government in this case could have done several things to show how or why the CI statements were reliable. They could have disclosed the CI's identity so that we could have investigated the CI, for example, to even confirm that they were together in the jail, as the government asserted. They could have corroborated the CI's statements beyond what they produced as far as what the second CI supposedly overheard as far as the conversation. They could have produced the CI for cross-examination, and they could have explained how the CI statements were consistent with other evidence in the case, but they did none of these things, again, declaring that, frankly, in this case, it wasn't worth it to the government to do so. I'm going to save the rest of my time for rebuttal, unless there's any other questions that the panel might have.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson?
May it please the court, I am Assistant United States Attorney Tracy Johnson. I am appearing in instead of AUSA Erica O'Neill, who is counsel of record in this case. Listening to the arguments that have been made by defense counsel, he's claiming that his client had a right to be sentenced on reliable information. And it is the government's position that the decision that was made by the district court was not an error. And although the defense counsel is focusing on whether or not the hearsay was reliable, when you look at the transcript of the sentencing records, you see that what Judge Randa actually relied upon was the fact that the defendant did not provide information in his second debrief and that he was not willing to discuss certain things. So the decision by the district court was actually made on the limitations set forth by the defendant in his debrief. Safety valve, when you're looking at a safety valve situation, it demands that the defendant provide all the information concerning the offense that is available to him. And that can be found in reference to U.S. v. Montes, which is a Seventh Circuit case. When we're talking about all information, for an example, in a drug case, it would include drug buyers, suppliers, and details of any of the defendant's involvement. And once the defendant placed limitations on his second debrief, he was not providing all information that was available to him. And according to Montes, a defendant's candor is something that can be taken into consideration by the court. And Mr. Nunez was not candid when he had his second debriefing and specifically stated that there was information he was not willing to provide. So in order to get around this, what Mr. Nunez is now trying to do is he is trying to switch the burden of proof onto the government, when in fact in a safety valve case the burden is actually on the defendant. Before I go into the Seventh Circuit cases, I'm going to backtrack and address the two cases that he set forth in his reply brief that come from the First and Ninth Circuit. With respect to Miranda versus Santiago, one of the biggest issues in that case was the fact that there was no binding plea agreement. And the district court, in its record, kept referring to the fact that he was not going to provide any departures for the defendant because there was no binding plea agreement. And in addition to that, the government gave absolutely no explanation why it did not believe the defendant was entitled to a safety valve, whereas in this particular case, the government did express why it believed the defendant was not entitled to a safety valve. In the Ninth Circuit case, it was involving an individual who was caught bringing heroin into the United States. And in that case, again, the government did not allege why they did not believe the defendant should receive a safety valve. And the government failed to object sufficiently. What it focused on instead was that they did not believe that he deserved a safety valve decrease because he had not been completely forthright during the time for him to get acceptance of responsibility. And so instead the government actually linked acceptance of responsibility to safety valve, and the court was saying that this was not correct. When we look at the primary case the defendant is relying upon, he is relying upon Camisano out of the Eighth Circuit, which is a case in which the government attempted to get...
Eighth Circuit or Ninth?
I believe it is Eighth Circuit. Camisano?
Let me...
I can check. Just a moment, Your Honor.
Maybe you're right. It doesn't make any difference.
Okay. But the information was provided by several unnamed confidential informants, and the court concluded that it was insufficiently corroborated. Now, the Seventh Circuit has taken Camisano under consideration in the Corbin case. And the Seventh Circuit noted that Camisano case does not stand for the proposition that non-hearsay corroboration is required in all cases. And it noticed that there are multiple levels of hearsay, but that there are ways to corroborate this hearsay. In our particular case, despite allegations by defense counsel, the information was corroborated. There were several things that were corroborated by the informant. First, there was the statement that the defendant was arrested at the Omega restaurant, and that was corroborated by the plea agreement. Second, there was the statement that Garza only had a gram of cocaine when he was arrested, and that was also corroborated by the record. Third, that the police searched Garza's residence and seized two guns, and that was also corroborated in a government proffer. Next, that the police searched the defendant's residence and that there was cocaine found. That was corroborated in the plea agreement. That the defendant had a trailer home different from the stash house on 8th Street. That was also corroborated in the plea agreement. That the defendant spoke to the police one time, but that the officer was different from the one that had arrested him. And that information would have came out in the first debrief because the special agent from the State Department of Justice that debriefed him during the first debrief was not the case agent, and it would be the case agent who would realize that the information provided in the first debrief was not necessarily accurate or truthful and would therefore call for a second debrief. And then finally, that the defendant was only going to tell information about who had robbed him, and that could be substantiated through the first proffer. So there is a substantial amount of information that was provided by the confidential informant that was able to be substantiated by the government. Now, one of the statements that repeatedly appears in defense's brief is that the government felt that it's frankly not worth disclosing the confidential informant's identity. This should not be taken lightly. It's not as though this is a throwaway. The fact of the matter is that this confidential informant had death threats. And so that was considered by
We understand why you might not want to do that. But are you telling us, I understood your argument to be primarily that of course a defendant is entitled as a matter of due process to be sentenced on the basis of reliable and accurate information, but that the key information here was what AUSA O'Neill provided about the second debrief, as Judge Bauer was asking about.
Yes.
Are you trying to suggest that apart from that information, the denial of the safety valve here could have been justifiably denied based solely on the issue of reliance on the confidential informant?
Yes, I am saying that it was, one, correct on the part of the district court not to grant the safety valve because he did not provide information or refused to disclose, and that the information that was provided was sufficiently corroborated as required to withstand.
So do you think the CI alone is enough?
Well, not just the CI alone, but the fact that the information provided by the CI could be substantiated by other sources. And those other sources, one of which would be the information that the defendant agreed to when he signed the plea agreement, and a number of the things that were listed.
Right, but that what was corroborated, though, was not the key information that led to denial of the safety valve, was it?
No, he did not corroborate the fact that that there was more. We were not able to corroborate or did not corroborate in the record that he had more knowledge about Schramm and Garza, other than the fact that prior to the sentencing of this defendant, which took place on February 5th, Schramm had already pled guilty to count six of the indictment before Judge Randa, essentially admitting that she was a keeper of the drug house. And the only difference between the plea agreements of the two of them is practically the last sentence in Schramm's facts, in which she acknowledges that she did allow Nunez to keep drugs in her house and that she was aware of it. So that general information would have been before the court because the court was the one that took the plea. And then finally, with respect to the shifting of the burden, and then the government will rest on its brief, is that the defendant is not entitled to shift the burden. In the Seventh Circuit, the Ramirez case, which is a drug case involving an individual who was being shipped items from Colombia, stated that when there is a departure, an upward departure, the burden falls on the government, and when the defendant is seeking a downward departure, such as in a safety valve, then the burden is on the defendant. I see that my time is up. I thank you very much and ask that the decision of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Mr. Donovan?
Thank you. I want to pick up where the government left off as far as the burden. We fully recognize and concede that it was our burden by a preponderance of the evidence to prove safety valve eligibility. Mr. Nunez did that. He went to his first debrief. He talks about his background, how he got started in the drug trade, names and details of people he dealt with, addresses, physical descriptions, where he obtained drugs, methods of operations, amounts, prices, payments, packaging, how often he dealt drugs, where he stored drugs, locations where drug deals occurred, how the drugs were transported. So he comes in, he does his first debrief, he meets his burden. And this is unlike the defendant Ramirez, who doesn't even engage in a debrief. Then, again, throughout the pre-sentence process, the report comes back, he's eligible. He satisfies all five categories. 2 weeks before sentencing, we receive an objection from the government, and the objection focuses on two issues. One, they say that Mr. Nunez falsely exculpated co-defendant Garza, and two, that he failed to discuss his girlfriend Angie Schramm. Now, first, in the first debrief, from looking at the notes, and the court can look for itself in the PSR addendum that's in the court record, Angie Schramm is not mentioned by anybody at all at the first debrief, including law enforcement agents that might have been wanting to know what her involvement was. Garza is mentioned, and in fact, Mr. Nunez does implicate Garza. He admits that he gave Garza a small amount of cocaine. So this is not a case where he's saying Garza had, I don't even know this guy. I don't know what's going on. He says he gave him cocaine, but he wasn't involved in the deal. So the only limit that appears here is that Mr. Nunez wouldn't support the government's theory of prosecution. Mr. Nunez is a drug dealer. He pled guilty, and we recognize that. But he would not implicate somebody that he felt he couldn't implicate, and that's what the government wanted. The government wanted Mr. Nunez to come in and say that Garza was involved, Garza is his right-hand man, and by the way, my girlfriend Angie Schramm is running a drug house. And only because Mr. Nunez wouldn't support their theory of prosecution, they feel that he wasn't fully open and honest. Now, the safety valve, this is not a 5K 1.1 situation. This is not where the government holds the keys and the government has to be the one to file the motion to its satisfaction that substantial assistance was provided. Safety valve requires only that Mr. Nunez come in, articulate what his involvement was, what his relevant conduct and background as far as the offense was, and nothing more. And our position is that he did that, he carried his burden, and at the point where they wanted to show that his burden wasn't carried and that he lied in certain aspects, it was their burden to carry that. And the last thing I want to say, actually I think that basically I guess takes care of what I wanted to say, but we feel that he did carry his burden, and it was the government's job to show otherwise. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Donovan. Thanks to all counsel. Mr. Donovan, you have an additional thanks to the court for accepting this appointment. Case was taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.